ask about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Gary Borger, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly gear. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Gary Borger about fly gear. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership, needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Gary, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Gary's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Gary's latest book, Fly Gear, courtesy of Gary Borger and Tomorrow River Press. To find out more about Gary's other books and products, go to GaryBorger.com, GaryBorger.com. Now, here's how you win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, or maybe two questions, as I so often do nowadays. So be the first one to answer that. Put your answer in the text box on our homepage where you're able to ask questions during the show. That's where you will answer this question if you want to win Gary's book, Fly Gear. Our guest tonight is Gary Borger. Gary has a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a professor emeritus of biology at the University of Wisconsin campus in Wausau, where he taught for 28 years. He was presented with Teacher of the Year Award on two different occasions. Gary is one of the world's foremost fly fishing educators. He has been a fly fisher since 1955, and since 1972 has taught classes and lectured internationally in all aspects of fly fishing for trout and salmon. A freelance writer and photographer and active member of the Outdoor Writers Association of America, Gary is also Midwest Field Editor for Fly Fishing Magazine, Editor-at-Large for Virtual Fly Ship and Fly Shop, and Fly Fishing Columnist for North American Fly Fishermen. He has written five best-selling books on fly fishing, nymphing, naturals, the Borger Color System, Designing Trout Flies and Presentation, as well as Fishing the Film, Reading Waters, Long Flies, The Angler's Predator, and his latest, Fly Gear, which are all part of a 20 planned titles of his fly fishing series. Gary pioneered fly fishing video instruction with the release of Nymphing in 1982, and since then has appeared in four videos for the 3M company, and in cooperation with the Federation of Fly Fishers, produced the environmental video, Where the Trout Are. His video production company has produced an additional 17 internationally acclaimed videos in the Skills of Fly Fishing series. In addition, he has appeared in TV productions on ESPN, OLN, and Gary is also a consultant on Robert Redford's movie, A River Runs Through It. He's a founding member of the Board of Governors for the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Casting Instructors Certification Program, and a member of the Order of the Jungle Cock, Trout Unlimited Fly, United Fly Tires, and Federation of Fly Fishers, and many more that we don't have time to list tonight. So, Gary, hey, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. If you do any more stuff, I won't be able to leave any time for you to answer questions during the show, you know. So.
Thanks, Roger. I got worn out just listening to you.
Yeah, well, you get, you know, you keep doing stuff, too. You know, keep writing
books.
Oh, well,
it's fun.
Yeah, well, as long as it's still fun, that's what's important. Huh? And everybody's learning, that's what's important, too.
That's right.
So you just got back last night from Alaska, so I have to ask you, you know, what were you doing, and were you picking cranberries or fishing up there?
I didn't pick any cranberries, and I didn't pick any blueberries, and I didn't chase any bears. I just ripped fish.
Yeah? Yeah, where did you go?
I was actually fishing at Noseum Lodge, and so we fished the Alagnac River, we fished the Nooshigak River, we fished the American River, and some others in that area, which would be to the west end of Lake Iliamna in the Katmai region.
Wow, sounds nice.
It was very nice.
Flew in there from Anchorage? Is that where you...
Yeah, we flew into King Salmon, and then from King Salmon it's about a half an hour flight to the lodge from there.
Yeah, out in the middle of nowhere, right?
Right, on the Quijack River.
Yeah, which is the way you like it up there.
That's right.
Good. And fishing was good?
Fishing was good.
Trout or salmon or both?
Both. Yep, we fished for king salmon, and then we fished for rainbow trout and with dry flies, because this time of the year they are feeding on some of the hatches up there. The pale morning duns were hatching, so we were able to catch some on dry flies. And then, of course, we fished for a sockeye salmon and chum salmon that are running at this time, too.
Chum salmon.
I love chums. They're my favorite Alaskan fish in terms of fighting power. They're just amazing.
Yeah.
They really
everybody talks about the silvers, you know, and the kings and all that, but we were up there 1 year where we kind of got in between, runs, and the silvers weren't quite running yet.
Yep.
The chums were running, and we just had a blast with them. Yeah.
Oh, they're something else.
And, they were hitting on nymphs and all kinds of stuff, so it was...
There are more 8-weight rods broken in Alaska by chum salmon than by any other species.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's a good segue. Let's talk about some equipment, huh?
All right.
You're writing this 20-book series. This is number 5, right?
That's correct.
And what prompted you to go to fly gear at this point, and why fly gear?
Well, I think an understanding of rods and reels and lines and leaders is essential if you're going to think about casting. And casting are the next two books coming up, Perfect Cast 1 and Perfect Cast 2. And I sort of wanted to establish some point that I could draw from when I'm talking about casting and talking about the lines, the way they perform, and the way rods perform, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so to do that, you know, in a series where everything is sort of continuous one after another, this seemed like a very good place to put fly gear.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I knew there was a reason. Just like I know there's a reason why you organize the book the way it is, too. So I'll be interesting to see that. You know, I organize the questions based upon, you know, how you organize the book.
Right.
So you started out in the book talking about line. And I'm suspecting that everything else kind of works its way out backwards from line. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's right, absolutely, because the line is the only really truly unique piece of equipment that fly fishers have. You know, everybody else has lures, everybody else has rods, everybody else has reels, you know, nets and the waders and all the other kind of stuff. But the line that we use is totally unique and totally different than anybody else's, and it's unique only to fly fishing. You can't do anything else with it. It's designed specifically for that purpose. And so the line is a good place to start because the way the rods are designed is based on the way the lines are designed, and the reels, of course, have to carry the lines and hold the line, so you have to think about how the reel is designed, in other words, to hold the line and the backing and so on and so on, and how they perform together as a unit. So the line is a really great place to start.
Yeah, yeah. Can you give us a little background? I mean, in your book you went into quite a bit of history on lines and how they've evolved. Can you kind of just give us a brief history of where it's all come and where it might be going?
Sure. Well, fly fishing started about 2,000 years ago, and for the first 1,850 years, it was basically horsehair, knotted horsehair lines. You couldn't cast them the way we cast lines today because, number one, they didn't have fly rods like we have today. It was basically what we call pole and string technology. In other words, a long pole with a string tied on the end. And that's the way fly fishing was until about 1850, when modern fly fishing began the way we know it today. Three things happened that allowed that to happen, and one of those was the evolution of the line. It went from a horsehair, knotted horsehair line, to braided silk. And, of course, that couldn't happen until the technology was there to do the braiding. But around 1850, they began developing machines that enabled them to braid silk and to braid silk in such a way that they could taper the ends of it and make the middle, you know, a belly on the line and then tapers on the ends. And the other two things that happened very quickly were the development of a fly rod that you could repeat the action of and make it short and light enough to cast with one hand. Of course, that was the six-cane split rod developed by Samuel Phillippe in eastern Pennsylvania. The other thing that happened was they began putting fixed rings on, or guides, as we now call them, on rods. They're called guides because they guide or direct the line from the bottom part of the rod all the way out to the tip part of the rod. That's why they're called guides instead of just rings. But originally they were just rings that hung down and they flopped around. Well, when that happened, when they developed rods that you could actually cast with one hand and repeat the action of, when they put fixed rings or guides on, and when they developed a fly line that would actually, didn't have any knots in it, would actually flow through the rings, then shooting line became possible. And once that happened, once shooting line became possible, it became possible for anglers then to adjust the length of the line as they were fishing. So rather than having a 20-foot pole with a 20-foot line attached to it, you could have a 9-foot pole with any length line because you could cast any length that you needed. Therefore, you could fish close or medium distance or long distances and do what needed to be done in terms of getting the fly to the fish. So that's when modern fly fishing began, right around 1850. By 1899, they were already in competition seeing who could cast the furthest. And it's pretty amazing how fast that all worked out.
I'm surprised that they had the equipment to braid something so tiny to – I guess it came from the textile industry, though.
It came from the textile industry. That's exactly right. It's interesting because most of what we do in fly fishing has come from other industries where there's enough money to be able to develop the technology. Graphite rods came from the aerospace industry, obviously. Vinyl lines came from the production of vinyl plastic, which was not made for fly lines, obviously. It was made for all sorts of other things. So it's very interesting how all these things have evolved and come about because of the technology that has come about in other industries. Because fly fishing itself is a rather small industry, and so it draws very heavily on outside sources to be able to produce the kind of products that anglers want and need to do what it is that they need to do. And when we look at fly fishing itself, you know, it's called fly fishing because they were fishing an imitation of the adult insect, which is called in England in those days the fly. So it was the fly. The mayfly was an insect-specific insect that hatched in May. It was a mayfly, but it was only one kind, one species, but they only called it the mayfly. Others were like the blue-winged olive or the sherry spinner, or and they had different names for every one of them. So in fly fishing, they were fishing just the adult insect imitation. That's where that name came from. But now, of course, with the advancement of the equipment that we have, we're able to use flies to catch all sorts of species, anything from tiny trout and bluegills all the way up to marlin and sailfish and everything in between. And we can do that because of the advancement of the equipment that's occurred in that basically 150-year period.
Yeah. Very interesting. So do you see where things are going with lines now? Is there a future? Or?
You know, there's been a really rapid evolution of fly lines within the last 20 years. And that has come about because of the interest in spey casting. Spey casting is also began around 1850 on the River Spey in Scotland. That's why it was called spey casting and not nest casting or tay casting, you know, or firth casting or something, you know. And it used a two-handed rod. And in modern spey casting, which really gained its impetus in this country from steelhead fishing on the West Coast. Spey fishing has been around for a long time in Europe, and there are a lot of people that two-hand spey fish. But in the United States, it became important to catch steelhead because the rivers are so large, and they figured out they could cast further, easier. Well, then what happened was they're trying to cast big, heavy-weighted flies with a spey line, which is not designed to do that. It's designed to cast lightweight flies that are supposed to skate or ride right under the surface of the water. Well, when you're trying to cast a heavy sink tip line, like a spey line, I mean like the skagit lines do, and you're trying to cast a heavy-weighted fly, the spey lines can't do it because they don't have enough mass. So somebody came up with a brilliant idea of making a skagit line, which is a very, very heavy line for a short distance. It's only 20 to 27 feet long. But you can put a sink tip on that, and you can put a heavily weighted fly, and even split shot, and you can actually cast it with a spey rod. The advantage of the spey rod is you don't have to actually make an overhead back cast. You're basically doing a modified or advanced roll cast technique is what you're doing. So when that happened, the manufacturers like Rio, Jim Vincent, who was the founder of Rio, was a wonderful spey caster. And he and some other guys, the ones that came up with this idea of the skin, he helped develop the skagit lines. Well, when that happened, they suddenly began to say, hey, if you can use this on a 15-foot rod, why can't you use it on a single-hand rod? And out of that came a tremendous variation of line profiles. You know, in the old days, we had a level line, we had a weight-forward line, and we had a double taper line. But now we have weight-forward lines in which the mass has been shifted toward the front. We call these wind cutters because there's more mass to the front, so it turns over much more sharply against the wind. We have ones in which we have a rear-shifted profile, so it's a lot more like the original spey lines, which turns over much more softly and more delicately and is designed to throw very tiny flies. And then a whole bunch of variations in between. They're even building skagit type lines for a single-hand rod, so they can either do spey casting, skagit casting, or they can just let it go and cast very, very long distances with it. So all sorts of things are happening. And what I see coming up now is still more advances in those kind of directions as people begin to understand how lines flow through the air and the effect of wind resistance on them and how much line do you really need to have out to be able to cast what you want to do and more specialization of lines for very particular kinds of fishing.
Right.
I think
right.
that's where all headed.
Yeah, in the past, 10, 15 years, I've seen so many, you know, specific lines, you know, bonefish lines, bass lines, permit lines. It goes on and on and on, you know.
So, yeah, and then you look at textured lines. I mean, textured lines aren't new either. Silk lines were all textured, every single one of them, because they were braided lines. And so now we begin to see, 25 years ago, I helped a company develop some textured lines, and they were great. But it didn't really catch on all that well, and then that particular company sort of went bankrupt and the lines went away. But now other companies like Scientific Anglers and, of course, Orvis, which has purchased Scientific Anglers, are developing lines with textures on the outside that are different, like dimpled like golf balls, so they fly better. So now suddenly we have lines that textured on the outside that slide through the guides better, so we get better shooting distance out of them. You get better floating because they can use materials on the outside that help them float. All sorts of interesting things are coming along. And, of course, that only expands our ability as fly fishers and the pursuit of whatever fish we like to pursue.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there was there's a show called Shark Tank on TV. I don't know.
Yes.
But not about fishing.
No. I know what it is.
About
selling ideas, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And a guy on there had, when you said that about the line going through the air, a guy had on that the other day, his reinvented wheel. It was actually a square, and so it supposedly would go smoother and faster than an actual wheel because there was less resistance to the ground, and yet it didn't wobble or anything. It was smooth and so forth. So it kind of made me think of that dimpled fly line of how less contact to the guide, right?
That's right, because, exactly right.
And not only more aerodynamic, but more less friction, going through.
Certainly.
Yeah, interesting, yeah. So, well, we got some. Let's dive into some of these questions people wrote in. We've got a few here on lines. Matt Ames wrote in. He says, let's talk sinking lines. What one or two general purpose sinking lines should a person have, and when should they use them?
Okay, sinking lines are largely, but not always, largely the purview of lake fishers. And if you're going to fish in lakes, you absolutely must have sinking lines. Now, so you can fish streams and not must have, but you must have if you're going to fish lakes. The reason is that fish will change depth very, very rapidly. For instance, they may be feeding up on top when the hatch is going on. When the hatch stops, they're down 20 feet feeding over a top of a weed bed. So you've got to get your line down there quickly and be able to change quickly. So the two lines that I would recommend for lake fishing, would be an intermediate line, and then probably a type 3 sinking line. In England, when they fish, now the English have developed lake fishing to a much, much higher degree than we have in this country, because most of the people there can't get on the private rivers, but they can fish the lakes because the lakes are all public, especially the reservoirs. So they may carry 5 lines during the day, a floating line, an intermediate, a type 1, a type 2, a type 5, maybe even a type 7 if it's deep water. And then they start out with a floating line, and as soon as the sun comes up and the fish start moving down, they'll move to an intermediate, and then as you go in, and they'll work their way down all the way to the bottom, and then they work their way back up at night. And they'll carry 5 fly rods, each with a different line on it. Well, we don't want to go to quite that extent, but being able to fish relatively shallow, intermediate line, if you have it all out, will allow you to fish down 12 to 15 feet. And the type 3 line will get you down there around 20 feet, which is the more likely the depth that you would be fishing if you're fishing in just a classic trout lake. In streams, probably a sink tip, a high-speed sink tip, is better than a full floating line. The reason being that in streams you've got current, and you need to be able to mend the line to be able to correct the drift. Sometimes you want a dead drift. Sometimes you want the fly to be moving. And so a line that has a high-speed, high-D tip on it gets the fly to the bottom quickly. The other one you might consider for stream fishing is an intermediate, because it's thinner than in diameter than a full floating line. And if there's a lot of wind, an intermediate will cut through the wind almost, you know, like a knife. It's amazing. And it will still float if you grease it up with fly flotant. So there's sort of a specialty thing there. But if you fish in a place where there's a lot of wind all the time, you might consider that concept. Okay. It's a really interesting one, and it works really well.
Yeah, good, good. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about lines and then rods. So stick with us, folks. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you can sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com, flatstime.com. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Gary Borger about fly gear. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, another question here, Gary.
Mm-hmm.
Normally I ask my guests what's going on in their fly fishing world, but you pretty much already told us that, so let's keep on with that. Next book, next year, will be on casting, right?
That's correct.
Okay, good. Looking forward to it. Let's see. Seth Harris in New Hampshire wrote, what are your thoughts on using fly line that is one size heavier than is called for by the rod manufacturer? In addition to increasing the distance of the cast, are there any bad effects?
Well, this whole concept of underlining and overlining is a very interesting one, because people will say, well, look, if you're casting short distances, you should overline your rod, because a rod is designed to cast 30 feet of fly line. So let's suppose that I have a fly rod that's designed to cast 30 feet of a 5-weight fly line, which is 140 grains of line. But I'm only fishing 20 feet. That means I'm not casting 140 grains of line. Now I'm casting more like a 3-weight line rather than a 5-weight line. So if I use a heavier line and I fish short, that means my rod will, quote-unquote, load better. Question becomes is, well, gosh, if I'm on the river and I need to cast just the leader, then what do I do? Because there are places where a 15-foot leader and a 9-foot rod, that's 24 feet, that's more than enough, and you're hiding down on your hands and knees, casting to a big trout that's rising on a spring creek, and you don't want them to see the line, and you just make a very small amount of rod movement. How in the heck do you cast that? Well, the answer is you have to know how to cast. And if you know how to cast, you don't worry about the line weight. Now, it's nice to match up the line weight with the rod so that you don't really tend to overline too much, because if the rod gets really heavily overlined, then you know, it's not going to respond as well as it would. You'd probably get a tailing loop. However, it's very easy with a 5-weight rod to cast a 12-weight line. All you have to be able to do is double haul really well and not try to cast 75 feet. If you cast 25 feet or 30 feet, you can easily cast a 12-weight line on a 5-weight rod. No problem at all. So there's a marriage between, you know, the equipment that you're using and your ability to cast. Now, I would tell people, okay, if you're one of these kind of people that's just sort of an average guy out there fishing, and you're always casting short, that means your casts to the end of the leader do not exceed 30 feet. Overlining by one line weight can sometimes make the rod feel more comfortable to you to cast. That's about the only advice I'm going to give anybody in terms of overlining or underlining a rod. Other than that, I say, if you can cast really well, you don't have to worry about that stuff.
Okay. Yeah, it's that was kind of the question in the back of my mind today before we started the show. I go, okay, well, Gary's going to talk about all this equipment and this and that and the other. I said, but I bet you I could give Gary Borger just about any piece of equipment and he'd still catch fish with it.
I'd be able to cast with it, let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and sometimes, like you said, you don't even need to cast. Just hanging out there.
Well, you know, let me just point out something. We'll do sort of a preview of coming attractions. In fact, I'm going to spring a surprise on you. And okay. That surprise is going to be, I also have a new DVD out, which is called The Perfect Cast 1, which is sort of a prelude of coming attractions of the book. So I'm also going to give away a free copy of that tonight with the second question. How's that?
Okay, sounds good.
All right, let's talk about casting for a couple seconds, because it does have something to do with fly lines.
Yeah.
And rods. And that is the fact that casting started out as what we call wrist casting. That is, you just use your wrist, and you flick the rod back and forth very quickly. That's the way you can cast just a leader. You have to flick the rod. That is, it moves very quickly, goes very, very fast at the end, and then stops very sharply. So instead of just waving it back and forth, it's actually flick, flick. If you can do that, you can easily cast just the leader, or 5 feet of line plus leader, or 15 feet of line plus a leader. You don't want to try to do that with 45 feet of line because your wrist isn't strong enough. Out of that came forearm casting, which is you use your forearm to help you lift line off the water, and then you flick it with your wrist. Out of that came whole arm casting, in which you would actually lift the rod with your whole arm and do the flick right at the top. Those three have evolved in that sequence. Wrist casting first, then forearm casting, and then whole arm casting. Almost nobody uses just strictly forearm casting. That was the old Bible under the arm kind of thing. And that's very uncomfortable to fish that way. And so what basically we have is wrist casting, which we can do in very short distances, and then whole arm casting, which we can do from 25 feet on out as far as we want to go.
Okay.
Yeah, and whole arm casting was available and developed and was used in tournaments as early as the 1899s. Then president of the Golden Gate Casting Club made a cast of 135 feet. And I guarantee you he didn't do that with wrist casting, and I guarantee you he didn't do it with forearm casting. He did it whole arm casting. And that record stood for 35 years until double hauling was introduced. And then once double hauling was introduced, people were obviously able to cast further because they could put more energy in the line and therefore it could fly further. Mm-hmm. So that's the way fly fishing developed. Now, you think about the way lines developed. Lines had to be coupled with that because they couldn't cast long distances with a standard fly line. Out of that long distance casting came weight forward lines, in which they put most of the weight of the line in the front with a skinny line behind it. And they were making their own lines. They were taking double tapered lines and cutting them off and making a 60-foot head and then putting an eye, which would be like a one-weight, silk line behind it to make the shooting heads to be able to cast those kind of distances. And then from that, one more thing, if you want to really cast long distances, you make a shooting head and you put monofilament behind it instead of a fly line behind it. So now you have a head with mono behind it. That allowed Jim Green, who was the original designer of the Fenwick rods, to be able to be the first guy to ever cast a fly line over 200 feet. And he did that because he had the mono behind there instead. So you can sort of see how the evolution of lines follows the evolution of our casting skills, you know, follows the evolution of the fly rods and all that sort of stuff as it goes along. They've all come together and been coupled together. That's why I think it's important to sort of understand how the history of all this flows, because then it allows us to see how each one of these things not only developed, but then their place in our use of them in angling and the development of our skills in angling and why we need to develop those certain things.
Right, right. Okay, we're going to wind this back to a real simple question. Well,
okay.
Maybe not so simple, but Mary Lilly in St. Paul, Minnesota. Mary wrote in and said, Gary, I have one rod, reel, and line, yet I'm doing small stream and big stream fishing and now some lake trout fishing in Minnesota lakes. Please talk about the need for lines that float, lines that sink, etc. I don't want to invest in a lot more gear. Just changing leaders seems to be a lot more economical. Am I compromising catching more fish in a big way?
Well, you know, this is another one of those things that we could go on all night about this. But let's back up one more step and say, hey, listen, fly fishing is our sport. We designed it for us to have fun with. The fish are not playing with us. They're very serious. We're the predator. They're the prey. But we've devised a technique for catching the prey that's unique and hopefully sometimes allows us to catch more prey than other people who are fishing. So, if you enjoy just using one rod of one weight, let's say it's like a 5-weight or a 6-weight, I would say in this case maybe it's a 6-weight, I would hope. A 6-weight would allow you to fish for all those things, to be able to use poppers and, you know, small dry flies and so on. But I would recommend, again, that if you're going to spend a lot of time fishing lakes, to get some sinking lines, especially an intermediate and like a type 3, because that'll allow you to get down a little bit deeper. And I fished lake trout up in Ontario, for example, in the fall when they're coming in to spawn. And there, a type 3 line is absolutely perfect. It allows you to get down to 12 feet and be able to do that within about 15 or 20 seconds. So it can cast out, you know, count it down 15, strip it in. It keeps the fly at that depth. Excellent. On the other hand, you know, a floating line is always essential. And let's say I'm fishing in a lake out in Oregon and I'm trying to fish chironomids in 20 feet of water. Well, I'm not going to use a sink tip for that because, number one, the chironomids are very small and the leaders have to be pretty light. So I'm going to use a 25-foot leader and allow that to do my work for me rather than trying to use a sinking line and so on. So there's lots of different ways in which we, you know, the techniques of fly fishing are linked to the particular kind of equipment that we're trying to utilize when we're actually fishing. So I would say, yeah, if you fish for stream trout, and then if you go and fish for bass and bluegills, and if you're trying to do some fishing for some smaller lake trout, not the big guys, a 6-weight rod probably would do it, and a floating line, obviously, an intermediate and a type 3. That should do it.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, I think back on the days when I was learning how to fly fish, you know, I had one rod, one reel, one line. And I fished that way for years, you know.
Me too.
And I had
a
heck of a good time, you know. So, you know, it's kind of all where you're at and what you want out of it. And you can still enjoy yourself with one rod and one reel and one line, I think. So.
But I'll bet you, Roger, you didn't take your trout rod when you went for tarpon.
No, well, I didn't fish for tarpon when I was 13.
Suddenly,
so.
It's a whole different ballgame, isn't it?
Yeah. That was a long ways away. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So, okay, well, let's talk about rods then. Martin Coleman wrote in, and he said, why is it when we start fly fishing, we tend to lean towards fast rods, and then after a while, we gravitate more to slower rods? I still have fast rods for wind, distance, and big fish, but favor my slower rods more and more. So can you just talk to fast versus slower and the whys and wherefores, I guess, is what...
Yeah, what we're really talking about is what people would call rod action. Action actually means the way the rod flexes under initial line load. It doesn't mean the way it's flexing when you're really putting power into it, because all rods, when you have power in them, I don't care if it's a fast or slow rod, are going to bend clear to the cork. If they don't, they're not doing what they're supposed to do. A fast rod would bend probably in the upper one-quarter to one-third of the rod. A medium-action rod bends down to maybe the top three-fifths, and a full-action rod or softer rod would bend all the way down to the cork under initial line load. Not when they're being cast with power, but under initial line load. And that would be initial line load with the length out designated, you know, by line weight. In other words, if you took 30 feet of a 5-weight and put it on a 5-weight rod, and line loaded it, you could tell whether it was a medium action or a full action or a fast action rod. A lot of anglers find fast action rods more, if they're real true fast action rods, more difficult to cast because you have to go faster in order to be able to bend the rod all the way down into the butt of the rod. And typically they use a longer line than the manufacturers call for. Let me just give you an example. In tournament casting, let's suppose you are casting a 5-weight rod in tournament casting. Most anglers picking that rod up would think it would be a 7 or an 8 weight, and yet it's designed to cast a 5. Why? Because the butt of the rod has to be extremely strong, because these guys aren't holding 30 feet of line in the air, they're probably holding 70 feet of line in the air. So because of that, they need a stronger rod. Faster rods, which are typically used in saltwater fishing or in places where you need to throw a lot of line, are designed specifically for that purpose, to throw a lot of line. Now, on the other side of it, remember a fly rod has two purposes, not just one. Maybe three purposes. One is to cast, one is to fight the fish, and one is to look pretty. If it's going to fight the fish, it's got to have enough strength in the butt of it to be able to fight the fish. So trout fishermen often tend to go toward the softer end of the scale, simply because if you're fishing for trout and you're using small hooks, now small being relative to like a tarpon rod or something, okay? If you're using small hooks and delicate tippets, then you need to have a rod that's going to allow you to fight the fish easily without breaking them off, and one that's going to allow you to be able to cast the light line, light fly, with a very easy rod motion. You don't want to be flicking it back and forth like a maniac. You want to just pick it up and gently lay it back out there again and not smash it into the water. So fly fishermen tend to shift down more toward the medium action rods. Saltwater fishermen tend to shift up toward the high end of it. There are some people who still like very, very, very soft rods, but I will point out to you that if you have a very soft rod, you had dang well better learn how to cast it, because most of the time, very soft rods will give you tailing loops every single cast because the angler moves the rod too fast and the tip hangs back. Then suddenly the tip jerks forward, dips down, and goes back up again, and that gives you a tailing loop every single time. So understanding how the rod performs in terms of casting, as well as how it performs in terms of what you're trying to achieve with it in terms of fly fishing, really, really has a serious consequence in what actually happens. For example, when I was fishing in Alaska this last week, I was using a 9-weight Hardy. Okay, their Pro Axis series, which is a relatively stiff rod. Most people picking it up would go like, hey, this is a pool cue kind of thing. But I'm fishing for chum salmon, and I'm fishing for king salmon with a 9-weight. And I caught some kings that were 30, 35 pounds with a 9-weight rod. And then, of course, the chums, they just fight like demons. So as much as taking the rod to cast with, I took it to fight fish with, too. And it's a fairly stiff rod because I want that butt strength in there to be able to lift those fish and really put my strength against them, power against them when I'm trying to fight them.
Yeah. Well, that was a very good explanation, I think, of that. And sounds like Martin favoring the slower rods must be a pretty good caster then. But what I heard you say is it tends to be, on both ends, it's going to be a little harder. On a very stiff rod or on a very soft rod, or the extremes where it's going to be harder to cast those, or you need to be a better caster. Is that correct?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. If you went and sampled across the whole board of fly fishing, all the fly fishers, and you ask them, gave them three rods, a fast action rod, a medium action rod, and a slow action rod, and said, now just cast this and feel how which one you would really like to be able to fish with. Most people pick the medium action rod.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is they tend to give us good loops. They're not more difficult to cast because you don't really have to struggle to bend them down into the butt. You're typically only casting 30 to 35 feet, and they perform extremely well at those distances.
Yeah. Okay, another question from Ben in San Francisco. He says, what's your favorite streamer rod, and what rod action do you prefer when throwing sinking lines and heavy flies?
Well, there I think I would say my favorite rod just for fishing, just streamers, and it would depend on what I'm fishing for again. If we're talking about streamers for trout fishing, then probably a 7-weight. And probably medium to medium fast action because I'm throwing those bigger flies. Now, something about casting fits in here too. If you use an elliptical stroke in the cast, that is you go back with the rod slightly sidearm and then come forward with the rod more straight up, so you go back, come around, and then go more with the rod straight up, you can cast giant split shot, you can cast sink tip lines, you can cast giant flies that are weighted and all that kind of stuff with any rod and not hit yourself. But again, I want the butt strength in there so that when I get a bigger fish on, which you often get with streamers and bucktails and leech imitations and so on, I've got enough butt strength there to be able to fight it. So I would, if you know, for regular trout kind of fishing, I would go to a 7-weight.
Okay. Boris, West Virginia, writes, does replacing the tip section of a graphite rod, which came flawed from the factory, and large, ugly drips of epoxy on top of the guides, change the action of this rod? This is a top-of-the-line graphite rod from a large and well-known manufacturer. So I guess he needs to replace that tip. And is wondering if it's going to match. Is that the question, I guess?
Yeah, typically what happens if you send a rod in to have a tip replaced is typically they just send you a new rod. It's easier to do that and make a new tip for it. However, manufacturers that are high-end manufacturers have very, very close tolerances on the outside diameter of the rod. And so it'd be pretty easy for them to simply replace the tip. Now, replacing the tip should not change the rod at all if it's a well-built rod. Although, you know, it might change it the tiniest, tiniest bit, but I seriously doubt if anybody would be able to tell that in just casting it. So, yeah, okay. Send it back and get it replaced. Don't fish with an ugly rod.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, yeah. This is a sport we're supposed to enjoy, and if you don't enjoy your fly rod that you're fishing with, why are you fishing with it?
Yeah, exactly. Greg Oslin in Montana and also in Georgia, I guess he spends time in both places, says, what types of rod materials, graphite, glass, or bamboo, and rod actions do you prefer fishing with and for what types of fishing situations? If you could have only one of the above material in action, which one would it likely be?
Okay, you should throw boron in there too, I guess. Those are the four major materials that are used, you know. Bamboo first, and then came glass, and then came graphite, and then came boron, basically in that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very easy for me to answer. First time I ever picked up a graphite rod was a Fenwick rod, because I was the Midwest director of the Fenwick Fly Fishing Schools, and so I had access to all that stuff very, very early on. Fenwick was the first company to do any serious graphite work. Shakespeare came out with graphite rods the same year that Fenwick did, but Fenwick had many, many, many more models than Shakespeare did. And they sort of possessed the market almost immediately. It's unfortunate they didn't continue on because the company got sold and so on and so on. That's another story altogether. But one of the guys who was at that time in charge of sales came back here to Midwest and brought a graphite rod, and we went fishing. And then he left the graphite rod with me. He allowed me to fish it all day. Well, I brought it home. And I said to Nancy, my wife, I said, you know, this graphite rod is unbelievable. You cannot believe what this thing does. Now, Nancy is a really, really good fly fisher, and she taught with me in my fly fishing schools for many years. And she said, oh, fly rod's a fly rod. And I said, listen, after lunch, we got to go out, and you have to cast this thing. So we had lunch. She goes out, and she casts it. This happened now. She goes, cast, 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 cast. Then she turns to me, and she said, well, where's yours? So that will give you an idea of the improvement from glass to graphite.
Yeah,
the reason
yeah.
that happened was graphite is a lighter weight fiber. Consequently, you can feel the tip of the rod better. Therefore, you can feel what the line is doing. And the job of the rod is to cast the line. One job is, anyway. If you can feel the tip. Now, you think about this for a second. The rod has the line going all the way from the butt through all the guides and coming out the tip. So the number one rule in casting is whatever the tip does, the line does. If I can feel the tip, guess what? I can cast better. And I can manipulate the line better. That's the advantage that graphite gave us. Because the rods are lighter, you can feel the tip better. And because you can feel the tip better, you can cast better. And you can fight the fish better because you can feel what the fish is doing much more easily than you can with other rods. Glass has a lot of mass to move. Cane has even more mass to move. Now, that doesn't mean I don't like cane rods and glass rods. No, not at all. I mean, we have all this equipment, and it's our sport to have fun with. I have some bamboo rods that are very high-end rods, and I love to fish with them every once in a while. But if I had one rod to use, it would be a graphite rod. Absolutely.
So boron doesn't offer more than graphite?
Interesting enough, boron is in weight is about the weight in between glass and graphite. Boron is an extremely difficult material to work with because what they do is they actually deposit borosilicate on the surface of a tungsten wire. So you've got tungsten wire in there, and you cannot cross the wires. They all have to be laid absolutely perfectly horizontal. If they cross and rub against one another at any time, they'll cut each other just like a knife. So boron's a hard material to work with, and it doesn't provide any advantages over graphite. If it did, everybody would be making boron rods. Mm-hmm. There isn't any advantage over it. Graphite is the best material we have ever found to this point in time, anyway, for manufacturing fly rods. And even the junkiest graphite rod now is way better than the original ones that they came out with, because we've learned so much about the technology of the graphite material itself, and then how to, you know, make the proper prepregs and how to roll them under the mandrels and bake them and so on and so on and so on.
Okay, good, good. So really, that graphite gave us some more of an extension of our arm and fingers, right? I mean, being able
that's
to
right. It allowed us
feel
to feel what
to
the line is doing, which is a very critical thing about casting and playing the fish. If you know what the line is doing, and you know how to control that, of course, casting is controlling the line, and so feeling the tip allows you to feel what's going on and be able to control it better. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Next question. Eric wrote in and asked, what is your opinion on Scandinavian-style casting? Would you use it to swing wet flies for trout?
Okay, what he's talking about here is what we call Scandi casting, or it was developed with two-handed rods and what they call a Scandi head. Now, you have to understand the profile of a spayline. A spayline is fat at the back and continuously gets skinnier. Lee Wolf developed a line which is called the triangle taper, which is built on that design. The idea in spay casting is you're always casting a lighter weight line with a heavier weight, because the heaviest line is at the back, the lighter line is at the front. So you're always casting, you know, more, a line that weighs less with a line that weighs more. All right, now, in Scandinavia, the rivers are not as large as they are in Scotland, where spay fishing began. There, let's say the river Ness, I mean, you got a river that's 200 yards wide. You can't possibly cast across that thing. So long, long casts were essential. So they developed lines with long, long heads on them. I mean, a short head on a spay line is 55 feet. A long one is 75 feet. Well, in Scandinavia, they have smaller rivers. So what they did was they made the same design, that is a rear-shifted profile, fat at the back and skinnier toward the front, like the triangle taper, but that's just a spay line. But instead of putting line behind it, they turned it into a shooting head, and they put mono behind it. Now, basically, what you have is a shooting head, but with a spayline-shaped head on the front. That's the Scandi system. What that allowed them to do was to be able to cast across these relatively smaller rivers and not have to have so much line on the back cast in the D-loop. This was a very good thing, because they're not fishing rivers that are 200 yards wide. They're only fishing rivers that are maybe 80 feet wide. And it's much, much simpler. Now, in casting, what they did is they developed a technique that's a little bit different than the technique that they use with typical spay rods. In a typical spay rod, the left hand and the right hand both do the same amount of work. With a Scandi system, the left hand does almost all the work if you're a right-handed caster. In other words, the bottom hand. And they call this underhand casting. So the rod that's down on the bottom hand of the two-handed rod, the one that's on the bottom, does most of the casting. The one up on top just sort of guides the rod back and forth in the correct direction so that it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. That particular style of casting is very effective for that particular kind of line. And some people use it for skagit lines, too, because you're fishing a relatively short line, and it works very well. You know, so it depends. Again, it's one of these kind of things. You wouldn't want to use a Scandi-style underhand casting with a 75-foot head on an 18-foot rod. You want to be able to, because you got to lift it, and you got to do all sorts of things with it. But with a shorter head, yes, it works great.
Okay.
That's a lot of talking for us.
Yeah.
pretty small question. Anyway.
That was a whole chapter in a book right there. Terry Martin in Portland, Oregon wrote in, and he pretty much answered this question, but he was asking about fiberglass rods, bamboo rods coming back into the market.
Uh-huh.
And then he asked about advantage and disadvantages. But let's just take his part of the question that says, why are they becoming popular again, fiberglass and bamboo?
Just because people like the nostalgic idea of fishing with them.
Oh, okay. Not because of performance or any other reason like that.
You know, some people say, well, glass is smoother. And the advantage of glass rods was they were tougher than nails.
Mm-hmm.
But they're heavy relative to other rods.
Yeah.
And they say, well, you know, they're softer. Well, you can make graphite soft. You can make it stiff. You can make it anything you want to make it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, there are people that really like the concept of glass rods. And there are people building some beautiful glass rods right now. Oh, my gosh. And some people are building now with faster actions and making them perform more like graphite and so on. The other advantage that glass had, of course, is it's less expensive.
Yeah.
In the old days, they built with what was called E-glass. Now they're using what's called S-glass. It's a faster version, a little stiffer fiber, so it performs a little bit better, and you can build stiffer rods, and there are things you can do with it you can't do with graphite, and it's, I mean, not do with graphite, can't do with bamboo, and you could never do it with E-glass. But they're also very tough because you have to use a fair amount of glass to make the rod. So you have a thicker wall, so it's a strong rod. And some people have been experimenting actually for not a short amount of time, but a fairly long time, with sort of hybrid rods in which the butt section is made out of glass and the tip section is made out of graphite. And as a consequence, you have a rod that's very strong in the butt section, but it's heavy. So most people have shied away from that kind of, you know, hybrid stuff.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, there is sort of a nostalgia. A lot of guys, at least people my age anyway, certainly grew up with glass as their primary rod. And so there's sort of a nostalgic look back. Yeah, I had a glass rod, and it was soft and slow, and I really loved it. And, you know, now all they have are these super-fast graphite rods. And there's a tendency in graphite manufacturers to make the faster rods because you can cast further with them.
Yeah.
Now, you go to any fly fishing show or any casting pond, and you watch the guys cast. Not a single one of them will ever be casting 30 feet and trying to make curve casts or dump casts. They'll all be trying to throw it to the other end of the pond. Therefore, fast rods achieve, obviously, notoriety because look how fast my rod is. Look, I can cast all the way to the end of the pond. Never fish that far, but I can cast that far.
Right, yeah. Well, that kind of brings us into an interesting question that was written in from Jim in Jefferson City, Missouri, talking about bamboo. I'll read this whole thing. It's kind of interesting, his approach. This past May, I retired and decided to celebrate the occasion by purchasing a new bamboo fly rod. Unfortunately, deciding which one to get turned out to be far more difficult than I thought it would, and I have yet to make my purchase. I have a large number of graphite fly rods in various weights, lengths, and actions. My only bamboo rod is 7'4" weight, which is fine for small streams. To go with this rod, I thought I would be nice to have a 6 weight for larger streams. I primarily enjoy dry fly fishing for trout and mend the line a lot. A long rod helps a great deal with mending, so I was thinking I would go with a 9-foot. I decided to go with a very expensive rod from a well-known maker in Montana. When I called them to ask some questions, one of the first things the gentleman asked me was, "Are you planning to fish with this rod?" I said, "Yes, I was quite a bit, in fact," and he sounded surprised. And then said that bamboo rods are best in lengths from 8-foot and shorter. When I asked him why, he said that they were more enjoyable to fish with. Do you agree with a bamboo rod that should be no more than 8 feet in length? I'm going to spend that kind of money on a rod. I want to be able to mend the line and catch a lot of fish with it. What would you recommend?
So
there you go.
Okay. Well, that's
long story.
That's a loaded question, but here's the answer. Why are longer rods in bamboo considered more difficult, and why would they want rods shorter than 8 feet? Answer is very simple. The amount of mass that you have to swing through the air. A bamboo rod is, even from a high-quality manufacturer, even one that's hollow, you know, I mean, they have rods that are hollow-form rods that are made out of cane. That's fine. Even those are going to weigh considerably more than glass or graphite, just because the amount of wood that has to be used, it's actually not wood, it's a type of grass, actually. So anyway, the amount of cane that has to be used, the mass of it itself, is very heavy. And most people do not find those long rods pleasant to fish with. That's why most manufacturers recommend you get 8 foot or shorter. Now, I know guys that are building super high-end rods, and they're making spey rods in cane. And there are a lot of people that want to buy them. Now, those are fairly heavy, but remember, they're casting with two hands. So you can do that. My recommendation would be, if you don't mind swinging the weight, and you can tell them what kind of action you want, and you don't get a slow action, old soft piece of junk, that you get something that's a true medium action rod, that you would enjoy it if you don't mind the weight. That's the only thing I can say, because you can build rods with exactly the same kind of action in bamboo, and in glass, and in graphite, and in boron. But you will always find the graphite to be lighter in weight, and more pleasant to handle on a whole day's fishing. But if you don't mind the weight and you want something just to enjoy the good quality of cane, you know, a handmade product, and like the beauty of it, fine. It's your sport. If you want it, go for it.
Yeah. Okay, Robin, we kind of answered some of this question, but I'm sure you have an opinion on this. Robin, Pennsylvania. He says, as a novice, I tend to buy things on recommendation and price. I purchased a TFO mangrove 8 weight as my birthday gift. I like that part. Purchased it as his birthday gift.
Yeah, good.
It's always nice to buy your own birthday gifts.
It is.
Fun.
Very nice.
And he also got an Orvis Access 4 weight tip flux early in the season. Mm-hmm. I noticed, so he must have had two birthdays in 1 year, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, I noticed that the TFO had a much better feel for my casting style. Can you talk about actions and rods? Well, you talked about actions and rods. But why do you think he likes that? Is it has to do with whether it's
well, one's a tip action rod and one's more of a medium action rod.
Yeah.
Medium
yeah.
action rods just are more pleasing because they don't require as quick a timing in the stroke, because in a fast rod, you actually have to move the rod faster during the stroke. And typically, if you're not casting long distances and you don't really understand that you have to flick the rod at the very end and stop it sharply, then, you know, and you just do a little bit softer kind of casting, you're going to find a medium action rod much, much more pleasing to cast.
Okay. Okay. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll dig into reels and then leaders. Lots of questions on leaders.
Okey-doke.
So stick with us, folks. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California, features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call them at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gary Borger about fly gear. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Let's see what we got here on the Internet quickly, Gary, before we move on. Okay. Okay, this is kind of a casting question, but I'll throw it out there. Phil McCartney wrote in. He says, when fishing in very windy conditions, I have read recommendations that casting so as to keep constant tension in the fly line is best, even though that means no positive stop is used on the back cast. What are your recommendations for casting well in very windy conditions?
Well, I guess it depends whether he's casting into the wind or if the wind's coming from the side or from the back. But let's say something about casting from the front and the concept of the elliptical stroke. The elliptical stroke was actually developed by a guy by the name of Hans Gebetsreuther, who was an Austrian guide on the River Traun in Austria. And it eventually became the casting style of a lot of other people over the years. And it's a very, very good one when there's wind behind you, because you can throw the cast low on the backstroke and then come around with what would be constant tension, that you never stop, you simply go back, and during what would be the pause of an overhead cast, you bring the rod up and around, and so the rod is more upright on the forward stroke. Therefore, you're throwing it low on the backstroke, sort of keeping it, quote-unquote, under the wind, if you will, a little closer to the ground where you have a little more wind drag, and then you're throwing it high on the forward stroke and allowing the wind which is behind you to catch it and help carry it out there. That works very well. If you're casting into the wind, best thing there to do is to cast with as much power as you possibly can, which means adding a double haul so that you can give the line as much energy as possible. Line era resistance to the line is one of the single most important problems that anglers face when trying to shoot distance or when trying to cast into the wind. And the only way to overcome that really is to either give the line a lot of energy and or to cast low on the forward stroke. So the elliptical stroke would allow you to do that, you know, both front and back. You can go back almost horizontal and then just, during the pause, bring the rod up and around a little bit and maybe come forward at a 45-degree angle with the rod instead of more horizontal. Again, doing that allows you to cast into the wind relatively easily. If the wind is coming in from your casting arm side, there's a couple solutions. One is cast sidearm with the rod pointing into the wind. That tends to keep the line away from your body a little bit. But I find that unsatisfactory, because what happens is when you're casting sidearm is it tends to blow the line to you And a lot of times you hit the rod on the forward stroke because the line has been blown to you and actually crosses the rod on the forward stroke. So what I do is I put the rod across the top of my head, and I cast with my arm on the other side, casting more horizontal that way. That keeps the line on my downwind side. Now, let's suppose you've made a back cast, and the wind is coming in lightly from your casting arm side. But all of a sudden, on the backstroke, you get a big gust coming. What you do is you simply go around in that circular motion and drop the rod across the top of your head, and then cast with the line on your left-hand side, or your line-hand side. That makes it very easy. So you go back and just take the rod right on around across the top of your head, so that the tip of the rod is actually, and the rod is actually above your head, but the tip is on the downwind side or on your line-hand side. And all those techniques work. And, of course, if you can double haul, that always helps when you're casting into the wind.
Okay, good, good. One other question from the Internet about rods. Bill in Loveland, I guess Colorado. What about New Age grips? What do you think about the other types, or are you cork only?
That's an interesting one. The reason I say it's interesting is because fly fishers are very, very hidebound. They are traditional right to the very end, and they want cork. That doesn't mean that other materials aren't good. It just means that people like the look of it.
So I like cork in my wine bottles, too.
Yeah, it's good, too. So, it's not whether or not these materials are any good. In fact, I think some of them are actually better than cork. But that doesn't really mean anything. You try to sell a rod without a cork grip on it to somebody and see how well you can do. You really can't. And remember, the customer's always right. So if they want cork on there, that's what they get.
Yeah. Well, I know cork's becoming harder to get.
It is. Especially really good quality
industry.
Stuff.
Yeah. And, what they did in the wine industry is they decided, okay, we'll put cork in the bottles that really make a difference, but in the ones that don't, we won't put cork. We'll go synthetic.
Yeah.
And or a screw top, which makes sense. If you're not going to store the wine for 40 years, you don't need that.
Right. Now, somebody could come up with a synthetic cork that looked like cork.
And breathed like cork.
And behaved sort of like cork. And I'm sure people would buy it.
Yeah.
Remember when hexagraph rods were around? Well, they couldn't really sell the hexagraphs very good unless they painted them to look like bamboo. Then they could sell them like hotcakes.
Yeah, that here again, another industry, a lot of the synthetic corks do look like cork for wine bottles. So there might be a crossover there at some point where slap it on a handle,
Yeah. And you'd have to put it on in rings, and you'd have to glue them up, and you'd have to turn it and sand it so that it felt a little bit like cork, et cetera, et cetera.
Who knows?
It might cost more to do that than to put cork on.
Okay, reels. Roy Fukushima in Orange, California wrote in. He says, I'm starting to video some of my fly fishing adventures with a GoPro and wondering if there are any good quality fly reels that have a clicker, as it would be awesome to hear the reel screaming when taking out drag. Can you name a few?
Yeah, there's a lot of reels that have a click on them. I mean, there are more with clicks than there are with not clicks. And the reason is, again, two things. Number one, tradition. The old fly reels all had a click on them, and when you cranked them, you heard the rrrr, and when the fish took them out, you heard the reel scream, obviously, as the line went out, or whine or whatever. Well, most manufacturers put some kind of a click mechanism on, not so much because they want the traditional sound of them, but because when you pull line off the reel, if there's nothing there to prevent the reel from overspinning, you'll get all kinds of backlashes. So they put a click drag on there, even if it's got a regular kind of a disc drag already built into the reel. They'll put some kind of click mechanism on so that when they pull it off, it doesn't overspin itself. Some of them with the drags, of course, they take that off and just let you adjust the drag so it doesn't overspin. But then, of course, you can't hear what the reel's doing. Now, some people say, well, they don't want to hear that noise, and other people do want to hear the noise. I personally like the noise because when the fish is taking offline, I can tell how fast it's running by the sound the reel makes. Mm-hmm. Now, people say, well, I can tell how fast it's running because I watch a fish in the water. Well, you get a tarpon on and let him run out 200 yards of line, and then you tell me how fast he's going. But the reel will tell you. If it's buzzing like crazy, the fish is going fast, and when it starts to slow down, you can get your hand up there without getting your knuckles knocked off and get it back onto that reel and start cranking again. So, like I say, it's not just the fact that you like the old sound or that you don't like the old sound. A lot of good reels out there right now that have clicks on them. And my recommendation would be go to a fly shop, pick up a reel, and just crank it and say, hey, this is the kind of sound I want.
Yeah, yeah. And he wants it loud for the video.
Yeah.
Yeah, now they have to make a GoPro that slides down the line onto the fish.
There you go.
Anyway, Terry Martin in Portland, Oregon wrote in. He says, how do you evaluate fishing reels? There are several varieties and styles, including large slash small arbors, different types of drag systems, and they are made of different types of materials. Do they make a difference? What should you look for? Why are they better than the reels we used 20 years ago?
And how much time do we have left in the program?
We haven't got to leaders yet.
Okay, let me give you fast answers.
We got 15 minutes, and you got to cover that plus leaders. So.
Oh, we need an hour just for leaders. Okay, here we go. You know, how do you pick a reel? That is a real good question. At one time, people said reels were just a place to store line. They have never really been that. From the very beginning, reels were to fight fish. That was their purpose because they were first used in Atlantic salmon fishing so that they could keep lots of line on and crank back, you know, crank the fish back. That's where they first came from. And they actually used winders that were used on barrels to tighten up barrels and stuff. That's what they first used. Very quickly, they developed reels once the technology was available to allow them to build reels. And the first fly reels actually looked like bait casting reels, and they were multipliers. But the multiplier part of it, the gears kept ripping off when they were catching big fish and the fish were running. So very quickly they went to the single action reels like we have today, in which the diameter of the spool is less than, the width of the spool is less than the diameter of the spool. That's the typical fly reel we have today. Now, let's jump from that concept to what you're going to use it for. Are you going to use it just for trout fishing, for small trout and small streams? Well, then you don't need a very big reel, and it only has to have a click drag on it, and you don't even need any more than 10 or 15 yards of backing on it. So a small reel that'll hold the line, and even in, when I'm fishing small streams, I don't use a whole fly line. I cut them back to like 60 feet because I'm never going to cast more than 30. So if that's, you know, all you're ever going to do, but if you're going to do lots of general fishing and you have plan on catching something that might be larger than 20 inches and it might run off a whole fly line plus some backing, then you have to have a reel that's large enough that's able to carry that and hold all that kind of stuff. That's number one consideration. Number two consideration is it better be super smooth. If it's not smooth, and if it catches, and if the spool wobbles when a big fish is running, very good chance you're going to break them off. Simply because the line will, you know, jerk and catch and grab and pull, and then the fish is going to have an opportunity to break you off. It has to be ultra smooth. Especially if you're going to go for larger fish that are going to fight hard. The biggest question really comes about in selecting a reel with a narrow arbor or a large arbor. Back in the days when all reels had small arbors on them, everybody put lots of backing on. Even the manufacturers recommended doing that. Why? Because it increased the diameter of the arbor. Backing was not only as an insurance policy, but because it increased the size of the arbor. So then somebody said, well, why don't we just make big arbors? So they started making large arbor reels. Large arbor reels have the advantage of having, the biggest advantage is, believe it or not, it's not cranking the fish in. The biggest advantage is the smoothness of the drag. Because as the line goes out, the diameter of the line left on the reel decreases. Therefore, the actual drag that you're applying to the reel increases. Let's say you have the reel set at a 2-pound drag with all the line on. When you get all the line pulled off, it's probably a 4-pound drag, simply because the outer diameter, the outside diameter of the line has decreased down to the point now where the arbor is smaller. And because it's smaller, you have a shorter radius arm. Because you have a shorter radius arm, it takes more torque to turn it. So you've got to make sure you have a nice smooth reel that operates very smoothly, that has a very good drag system that operates very smoothly. And if that's the case, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's large arbor or small arbor. The advantage of a large arbor is that you can gain more line with each crank. That's the real advantage of it. So if you're in a position where you're going to be fighting big fish a lot, then a larger arbor reel does give you an advantage because it allows you to recover line faster than a small diameter would, even with a lot of backing on a small arbor reel. So, there's a lot of things to consider, and then you got to look at the fact of whether it's a cast reel or whether it's a machined reel. Almost all of the reels that are even medium end to high end are machined reels. They're CNC machines, so you can make them fairly quickly. You can make them very accurately. You can make them nice and smooth. You know, you can make them, and then of course, how pretty are they? Do I like the look of this reel? Do I like the way the holes are put into it? The holes didn't come about in modern fly fishing. They came when reels first started. Holes came out because it helped you to dry the silk line, which was on there, which had to be dried anyway. But now we put the holes in there to decrease the weight of the reel. And so we use, you know, high-end, usually reels are made out of high-end aircraft-grade aluminum. If they're too soft, of course, they'll bang, bend, and all that kind of stuff when you drop them on the rocks. So most of them are made out of high-end aircraft aluminum, which is pretty dang tough. And they're machined, CNC machined, and they give you very, very good performance. And most of them, you know, most of them, the way they're built, will literally last a lifetime if they're cared for.
Right, right. So when you see in saltwater, you know, you see the larger reels. Am I reading that correctly in that they're probably large arbor reels for the reasons you just said, but then they also have to have backing, and by the time you get that plus the line on, you need a larger reel altogether to just make that all happen. Is that correct?
Yeah, and if you're fishing saltwater stuff, most of the saltwater reels are not large arbor for the simple reason it'd be enormous. Depending on what kind of fish you're fishing for, so, you know, if you're fishing for bonefish, hey, large arbor reel works fine. If you're going after marlin, no, because you got to have 600 yards of backing on there. Uh-huh. You can't. You mean the reel would be the size of a drum if you made it with a large arbor. So
yeah.
Most of those are smaller arbor reels, but they're very precisely made and they have to be strong. I mean, most people don't realize how strong, like a 125-pound tarpon is.
Yeah.
I always tell people it's like hooking onto a Volkswagen on the freeway. The only way you can beat it is wait till it runs out of gas.
Yeah.
You better have some backing on there. You better understand, you know, what it is to fight a fish and how to fight fish. A lot of guys that are fighting the big fish now don't even use the rod. They just play them straight off the reel.
Mm-hmm.
So they want a reel that has very, very precise and very accurate drag settings that are very, very consistent, and the reel starts very smoothly and allows the fish to run very quickly, and they can, you know, they let it run, and then they set the drag a little heavier and let it run again, set the drag a little heavier and let it run again, and typically it's 3-4 runs and the fish is tired and they drag him in. So it depends on what you're trying to do with the reel, like we said before, and how precision it has to be.
Yeah.
One time years ago, a friend of mine, this was in the days before they really machined reels, when they put them all together with screws, he went out Mako shark fishing and he hooked us a giant Mako, and they said certainly it would have been world record at the time. And he's fighting this thing and fighting it and fighting it and fighting it and fighting it. And all of a sudden he hears this grr, 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 and he looks down and the screws are coming out of the reel. And then the reel just explodes and comes apart. And, of course, he loses the fish, you know, the shark in that case.
Yeah.
So you need
a
reel that's precision made, one that's – and you can pay a lot of money for them, of course.
Yeah. But balanced for your needs. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yep.
Yeah, you know a bonefish is only going to run so far and then that's it. It's not.
That's right.
End of the other end of the Caribbean, you know. So,
that's right.
Good point. Okay, we're running out of time, but so I'm going to combine a lot of these leader questions because there's, you know, they all cross over one another, but basically it distills down to, you know, the idea of fluorocarbon versus mono versus, I've lost my train of thought.
Copolymers and that sort of thing, yeah.
Well, now the, ferrule leaders.
Oh, ferrule leaders, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've got those three different kinds of leaders that are basically out there. Advantages, disadvantages, those are the main questions. And then we had some questions on, you know, loop connections. But let's just hit the first part here of when and where and why of those three types of leaders.
Okay. Well, ferrule leaders basically are advantageous in the fact that they're very soft, and so they tend to hold a tight loop more easily than mono leaders. That doesn't mean that mono leaders won't hold tight loops, it just means that the furled ones perform a little better in that regard. The problem with furled leaders is they're furled. In other words, they have lots of cracks and spaces that dirt can get into, that water can get into, and if you're not careful and you flick it out over a fish, you can throw all kinds of water over the top of them. So if you're going to do that, you need to use furled leaders. You need to pick it up. You need to make one false cast at least away from the fish in a place where the fish is not going to see any line flash and he's not going to see the water that sprays off of there, and then make the cast at the fish. If you're going to use fluorocarbon, you have to understand that even though fluorocarbon now, the new fluorocarbons are very strong, it's not any stronger than the new copolymers, and you're paying a lot more for it. Now, fluorocarbon has found real place in fishing for steelhead and in saltwater fishing where they use it for the shock tippet, which is really an abrasion tippet. A 60-pound fluorocarbon has about the same appearance in the water as 40-pound nylon, simply because fluorocarbon's refractive index is closer to the refractive index of water than that of nylon. Refractive index of water is 1.33. Well, the refractive index of nylon is much higher than the refractive index of fluorocarbon, so when you put fluorocarbon under the water, it tends to look more, quote-unquote, less, maybe visible, more invisible than monofilament. However, when you put thin diameter mono and thin diameter nylon underwater, basically you can't tell the difference. Because the mono is so thin in diameter, it doesn't really matter. When you're using heavier stuff, it does matter. The other thing you got to remember is that fluorocarbon is heavier than water, considerably heavier and considerably heavier than nylon. As a consequence, if you're going to fish dry flies with it a lot, you have to grease it up. Because if you don't grease it up, it tends to sink on you. Then when you go to lift the fly, you get that kind of a noise. And that, of course, can spook the fish because it jerks the fly underwater and you get that popping sound. So you have to be very careful how you lift it off the water. Well, guys say, why don't you use it for nymph fishing? Well, I guess you could, but it doesn't sink the nymph any better than the nymph on nylon. So, as you know, there's uses for each one of these kind of things. Now, there's new materials, you know, that are coming out, copolymers that are so strong you can't even believe it. I mean, you can get material called Stroft, S-T-R-O-F-T, which is a German material, and that in 5X is as strong as most nylon in 4X or even 3X. It's a copolymer. It's a very, very tough material. So we're seeing all sorts of, you know, advancements in development in leader material as we go along and in leaders themselves. Now, what do I use? Straight old mono. I mean, I use Stroft as tipping material, but I use Maxima for the butt section and Maxima for the tapered section. Why? Because I've used it for years and years and years, and I understand perfectly how it works. It's thinner than diameter than soft materials, but not as thin as you would be very, very stiff materials. It's sort of a medium stiffness. And I know exactly what the performance characteristics are, and I know exactly what diameters to use to do whatever it is I need to do with it when I'm building my own leaders. I don't use fluorocarbon very much. I'd use it if I was going to be fishing for tarpon, certainly for the shock tippet. And I basically don't use furled leaders very much either because of the problem of picking up so much water and dirt and that kind of stuff. Yes, it's fun to do it. Yes, it's fun to use a silk line with a furled leader. But what do you do for the tippet? Well, typically you use a tippet ring on the end of a furled leader, and then you put a piece of mono on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it depends on what you're trying to do, and again, it depends on how far back you want to go in the tradition of fly fishing and what you're trying to accomplish and whether you really like this or don't like this.
So you still tie section leaders?
I still build all my own leaders. Absolutely.
Okay. That was another question that came up. And that mainly for the reason that you can design them for the exact purpose that you want.
I can build in the performance characteristics that I want in the leader and not the performance characteristics that the manufacturer put in because they don't put in the characteristics that I want. For example, if I want a long, stiff butt section, I cannot find that in any manufactured leader, but I can find it in ones that I build.
Okay. Here's a question from Chris in Rogers, Arkansas. He says, Gary, thank you for the incredible gift. You taught me how to fly fish at Vermejo Park Ranch in 1989.
Sure.
There are basically three approaches to connecting leader to fly line. Use the built-in welded loop on the line and loop in your leader, which is the easiest and cleanest approach, but can have a hinging effect. Cut off the loop of your line and tie the leader butt section using a nail knot or something similar, which can provide the most direct connection but requires the most effort to change leaders. And cut off the welded loop on the line and tie in a heavy mono loop and loop your leader to that. I believe you recommend employ this third approach. Why is that true, and why is this the best system in your view? Any drawbacks?
Well, when loops first came out on fly lines, they were incorrectly made and they were too heavy. Now think about this for a second. Why do they taper a fly line? To take weight off the end so that as it goes forward, the amount of mass that's there decreases. Well, if you decrease the mass, you can increase the acceleration, but at the same time, you're also increasing the inability of the line to perform against wind or against the air as it's flowing. So what happens is in the tapers, it tends to turn over, it tends to slow down at the end, and it tends to deliver the fly more softly. All you have to do is cast a line that's a level line, which is not tapered at all, versus a tapered line, and you'll discover very quickly the effect that that taper has. The level line will turn over like a shot and actually kick over and smash into the water like crazy. And the tapered line doesn't do that if it's manufactured correctly. Well, now, if you put a loop on the end, you've added weight to the end. In fact, you've added as much weight to the end as you took off in making the taper. So basically, you've turned a $100 tapered line into a $15 level line by doing that. And it crashes down on the surface. As time has gone on, the manufacturers, realizing that, have made the loops a little smaller and not quite so heavy and on and on. Now, if you're fishing for fish with heavier rods and heavier lines and big, heavy flies, that concept of the line crashing down is not nearly as important as it is in more delicate lines. Why? Because you have a heavy fly that you're trying to deliver, and a level line will actually deliver a heavier fly than will a tapered line. So adding a little weight at the end, in fact, that's the concept of the wind cutter design, is you add more weight toward the end of the line so that it will actually turn over harder, not less hard, but harder so that it can throw the heavy fly. And so you look, you've got clouser lines, you've got bass lines. All those are what we call wind cutter designs, in which the weight has been shifted more toward the tip, and the tapers are much shorter. So you can deliver more energy to the leader, more energy to the fly. Well, if you don't want to deliver that much, you make the tapers longer on the fly lines. And likewise, you try to make them as light as possible, so you don't want loops on there. So classically in my trout lines, what I do is I cut the loops off, and I put on what we call a connector, that is, a piece of monofilament that's tied on with a needle knot. In other words, you poke the needle in the end of the fly line and out the side and run the leader through the center of the fly line and out the side, then you tie a nail knot on there. And then you make that about 15 inches long, you put a perfection loop on the other end. Then you just loop the leaders onto the connector section and loop them off as you need to. That's what I use for trout fishing. I use it for most of my fishing, actually. But like I say, in heavier lines, like if it already comes with a loop on there, and it's a good loop, not the giant thing that's attached, the big thing that's all heavy, that's fine. That'll work fine for the heavier lines, but it doesn't work so well for the lighter lines. So I just put the connector systems on the lighter lines and go with it that way.
Okay, good. Well, we've run out of time. We've gone over already, and there's still more questions, but we've got to call it quits at some point here. So sorry, folks, if we didn't get your question, but Gary just provided you a whole book's worth of information tonight, so you should be happy, and you should have learned a lot. So, but we got to wind this thing up, and stick with me, Gary, because we're going to give away your book here in a minute, and I want to help
you. And the DVD.
Yeah, and the DVD, and what I want to make sure you you're going to be the judge of the correct answers here. So,
all right.
So hang tight here. We're also going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. Stay around for that as well. So just one second here. Okay, just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what do you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Okay, now for the drawings here. New to the drawing for the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you want to find out more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. Great organization to support and be part of. So if you don't win tonight, go check that out. Okay, so let's see with from our database, Ronald Dunton in Wyoming. Ronald Dunton in Wyoming. So congratulations, Ronald, on winning that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. We'll contact you by email and tell you what you need to do to collect on that membership. Now let's look at Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. If you want to know more about that, go to AmatoBooks.com and check out all the books that Amato has in there that they offer and the other periodicals. Okay, we got a winner there. It's Jeffrey Thrash in Pennsylvania. So congratulations, Jeffrey, on winning that one-year subscription at the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal from Amato Books. So congrats. Okay, let's give away a copy of Gary Borger's latest book, Fly Gear, fifth in a series of 20, and illustrations by his son, Jason Borger. So they work as a team creating these books, and I'll tell you, you'll want to get the whole library once you get one of these books. So definitely pay attention here. And so I'm going to ask one question, but it's going to be have three answers to it. And we'll give the book away to the first person that gets it right. We'll give the DVD away to the second person that gets it right. Okay? So let me clear my queue here out. And you're going to be putting your answers in on the front page of our website in that text box. You'll need to include your name and your email address there. And the question is, when Gary was talking about helping a woman out that asked a question about how many different lines she needed, he gave a recommendation of three different lines that he thought would be good for most all-around fishing that she was doing. So what were those three lines, three different types of lines? Okay. And we'll see what we got. Okay, I need to know what kind of, I need you to be more specific, Dean. You got the first two right. The last one, I want something more specific. Okay, we've got this one I think might be it. Gary, floating, intermediate, and type 3 sinking.
That's correct.
Okay, so David Wilhelm, you got... you just got the Fly Gear book by Gary Borger. So, David, what you're going to need to do is send me, and you can do it in that same text box, send me your mailing address. I've got your name and your email address here, so I need your mailing address so Gary can send that directly to you. Okay, now I'm looking for our second winner for the casting DVD that's brand new that Gary's just put out. And let's see if we get the next one. Here's the answer to this one, Gary. What is intermediate, type 3, and floating? I guess this is from Jeopardy, right? You know what
I
is?
I guess so.
I think he probably got it too then, right?
I would say.
Okay, so that's Bill Hefner in Nazareth. Not sure where Nazareth is, but
Nazareth,
Bill,
Pennsylvania,
okay.
Probably.
Yeah, so Bill, congratulations on that. Can always use some extra casting tips, and I'm sure that's what you're going to get in that DVD. So again, same to you. Fill out the form and put in your address so that I've got your email address and your name here. Just give me your mailing address so that Gary can send those to you. He'll be sending those directly from his office out to you guys. So congrats, and thanks for playing on that, and Gary, hey, a pleasure again. Looks like we got to do this, 15 more times?
At least.
to cover all your library of books that you're creating, which is a real gift to the fly fishing world. So
thank you
for doing it. I think it's just wonderful. Go to GaryBorger.com, GaryBorger.com. You can read about the other books that he's published and the ones coming up, plus a lot of other great information there. So thanks, Gary, for being on the show. It's just a pleasure again.
My pleasure, Roger, and thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Our next broadcast is going to be on August 5th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, we're going to interview Gary Lewis, and our topic for the show will be Reading Water Challenges in Mount Hood Country. Gary has fished in 7 countries and across the U.S., and one challenge that he always faces is how to read water, especially new water or water that has been affected by weather or other external factors. So listen in as we explore 3 fisheries in the Mount Hood country of Oregon and how each presents a different challenge when reading the water. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Tomorrow River Press, Flats Time Charters, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska and Keeney's Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.